Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
New York and Chicago, two of America's largest cities, and both grappling with how to curb gun violence. Good morning, New York. Good morning, Chicago. I'm Brian Lehrer, host of The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC in New York. This hour, we bring you a special co-broadcast with our Chicago sister station, WBEZ, to talk about guns, policing, civil liberties, and how to make all our streets safer.
And in Chicago, I'm Tony Sarabia, host of The Morning Shift. We're live in both cities right now, and the phones are open for your calls, whether you are listening in New York, Chicago, or elsewhere. And all this hour, we want to hear from you. How should your communities be policed? Here's a question for you here in Chicago. Are police failing to bring down crime? And in New York, are the police keeping crime low in your city, but at too high a price in civil liberties?
Yes, listeners, in both cities, our question for you this hour, if you live in a high-crime neighborhood, and that's really who we want to hear from in New York and Chicago, if you live in a high-crime neighborhood, what do you want from the police, and are you getting it? What do you want from the police, and are you getting it? Maybe there's a unified approach that could serve both cities' needs. Those of you who live in a neighborhood affected by gun violence, give us a call. We want to hear from cops, parents, activists, teachers, kids. The phones are open, and it's the same number in each city that you would normally dial. Here in New York, that's 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692.
And in Chicago, it's the same number you're used to, 312-923-WBEZ, 312-923-9239. Brian, thanks so much for doing this. Now, obviously, crime is a major issue for both of our cities, and I guess the first thing I'd like to know, is there anything that Chicagoans need to know about policing in New York City?
Well, first, thank you, Tony. This is so cool that we're doing this together.
Yeah.
I think people in cities should share our experiences a lot more than they do, so I'm so psyched for this. And for me, the first answer to your question is that Michael Bloomberg is the public health mayor. And that means he is very prevention-oriented. He banned smoking in restaurants rather than look for a cure for cancer. And he tries to get guns off the streets before they are used in crimes, not just prosecute the shooters. So here is the mayor, for example, speaking in a Brooklyn church last summer, speaking about himself and his police commissioner, Ray Kelly.
Now, from our first days in office, Ray and I had two goals for the NYPD. Make our streets safer, and move to beyond the old racial boundaries. Today, New York is the safest big city in America by far. Boston and Chicago, Boston where I grew up, Chicago have a lot of friends. Nice towns. But you are about twice as likely to be murdered there as you are in New York City.
So that was a little bit off mic, but I think everybody could hear it. And he kind of took a shot at your town there at the end.
Yes, he
which
did.
Statistically is even underestimating the 2012 numbers. I think as of last year, Chicagoans were not just twice as likely to be murdered as New Yorkers, but almost four times as likely.
Yeah, our figure from 2012 was 506 homicides.
And for us, 414. And Chicago, as I understand it, only has about a third as many people as New York City, so do the math. So what's the first thing you think New Yorkers need to know about policing in Chicago?
Well, you know, I think, Brian, the thing that people should come away with is, in my sense, is that it's constantly in flux. Now, I wouldn't go as far to say that it's a knee-jerk approach to any situation that comes up, but it's clear that both the city's mayor, Rahm Emanuel, and the police superintendent, Gary McCarthy, are always on the lookout for what can work best, whether it comes to gun violence or lower levels of crime. And Chicago aldermen are in on this as well. I mean, they just recently passed an ordinance that would up the fines and create mandatory jail time for so-called quality of life crimes. Now, you in New York know a lot about that because, again, it's taking a page from New York and the whole broken windows philosophy. And just to give you an example, since the mayor has come into town, there have been a lot of changes. There's been a big boost, a return, if you will, to community policing, which started in Chicago in 1993. He's created Chicago's first comprehensive gang violence reduction initiative, depoliticizing the department, instituting ComStat, which again comes from New York City. Mm-hmm. So there's Operation Impact to saturate crime, high crime areas. So it seems like, you know, they're constantly looking for new ways to reduce crime.
Do you think?
And here's go ahead.
Go ahead. No, you go ahead. You're going to set up a clip.
Yeah, we had the superintendent on our afternoon shift yesterday, and it's interesting because he, again, mentions New York.
Five things. Assault weapons, okay? They have an assault weapons ban. The second one is extended magazines. The more bullets in the gun, the more likely the individual gets hit. The more likely they get hit, the more likely they die. The third point is universal background checks, and I'm really pleased that Congress has now put it on the table that there will be a debate about this. And the Bloomberg administration did a sting on this, where I think they went to 32 gun shows across the country, and they checked. When they did it, they said, okay, I want to buy this gun. Are you going to do a background check? And he says, no, I don't have to. I'm a collector. He says, well, that's good, because if you do, I'm not going to pass it. And he says, I don't care about that. Cash and carry, $200. That gun's yours. Mm. My fifth point is mandatory minimums of 3.5 years for illegal gun possession.
So, Tony, again, remind us, was that your police commissioner, McCarthy?
That was our police superintendent, Gary McCarthy, who actually worked for the police department in New York City and then in Newark, New Jersey. So he comes to Chicago with a lot of experience in both cities.
And he comes originally from the Bronx. So listeners in New York and Chicago, while your calls are coming in and they're getting screened, let's get a little more context from someone who has looked at crime and policing in both cities. She is Tracy Mears, professor at the Yale Law School and formerly criminal justice professor at the University of Chicago. Dr. Mears, thanks very much for joining us. Hello from New York and Chicago.
Good morning.
Hi, Dr. Mears.
So Tracy
is fine.
So I've been reading up, Tracy, Dr. Mears, as you will, on various theories of why Chicago has a murder rate nearly four times that of New York. And here are the big ones that I've come up with. Deeper pockets of poverty, more entrenched multi-generational gangs, looser enforcement of nonviolent gun possession, that is simple possession, budget cuts to the police, better anti-gang programs in New York, and controversially, the NYPD Stop and Frisk program, which, for those of you in Chicago who don't know, stopped 700,000 people in 2011 on the vaguest hint that they might be carrying an illegal gun. So leaving aside the Stop and Frisk debate for a minute, Tracy, does that list ring true to you?
Some of the things on the list do ring true, Brian. Let me pick out a couple. First of all, the gang structure in Chicago is very different from that in New York. I'm sure there are historical reasons, sociological reasons, but it is true that for a long time, the gangs in Chicago were larger, more organized, more concentrated, and now the gangs in Chicago are breaking up in particular ways. And when networks of people who are involved in violence break up, that causes more violence. Since the gangs in New York were never as big or as concentrated as the ones in Chicago, that particular problem is not present in New York. It is also true that there has been looser enforcement of gun laws, gun possession laws in Chicago as contrasted with New York, despite the fact that I think both cities have similarly strict gun laws. Another thing to pay attention to is that Chicago, unlike New York, is surrounded by areas that have laxer gun laws as a whole. So there are just a lot more guns in Chicago than there are in New York. Let's take a look at last year's statistics. I think just over 3,000 guns were picked up in New York City, contrasted with, you know, close to 14,000, maybe more, in Chicago, and that's true annually. There are 10, you know, order of magnitude in the thousands more guns
in
Chicago.
And Tony, that's without Stop and Frisk.
Yeah, that's without Stop and Frisk, which Gary McCarthy says that police officers do on occasion. And yesterday during our show in the afternoon, he said, you know, how do you think police find guns? They don't get them from the criminals. Here's what I'm wondering, Tracy, though. You know, Brian mentioned all these differences between Chicago and New York. And I'm wondering, is part of it because of the size of Chicago? In other words, you know, yes, we may have a bigger gang problem, but I wonder if that's because of the density. See what I mean? Because our city is smaller. It's going to be more concentrated.
So smaller population-wise, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's smaller population-wise, geographically much bigger. And so here's what's going to be similar in the two cities. You know, Brian mentioned the homicide rate in New York. My estimation of that is about 5 per 100,000 compared to last year in Chicago, which was about 18 per 100,000. But in both cities, it's not fair to say that the average person walking around in those cities faces the same risk. It's just not true. Homicide is concentrated. It's concentrated demographically, and it's concentrated geographically, right? So the places that are really, really dangerous in Chicago, the homicide rate is like 50 per 100,000. But if you actually look at the people who experience it, young African-American men who live in the highest crime areas, their homicide
which
rate
here in,
is...
Which here in Chicago, Brian, for listeners in New York, is Chicago's primarily west side and south and far south side.
And New York.
And that's also where there are areas of poverty as well.
Correct.
Right. And the same kinds of concentrations of homicide victims as well as perpetrators are in similar neighborhoods here, to be sure.
That's right. That's true. But here's the difference, that I think that the areas in Chicago, because they are geographically larger, are much more isolated. So this gets to your point, Brian, about sort of, I think you said, deeper, more entrenched pockets of poverty.
Right.
I think there's deeper, more entrenched pockets, in part because the isolation in Chicago of those areas and neighborhoods are greater. And the best work on that is done by my former colleague, Robert Sampson, who's now at Harvard.
So I wonder if you think, Tracy, that that implies certain police strategies that would be different from those pursued in New York.
Well, it's certainly true that in New York, the police strategies have been different. I think because it's geographically smaller, New York can try to make the claim that the stop, question, and frisk strategy is a good one to actually tamp down crime. I don't think there are any empirics that show that that's true. And it's also the case that that kind of interaction with people leads to mistrust of the police, which, you know, in the long run is not going to help keep crime down. It does mean in Chicago, though, that the kinds of strategies that Superintendent McCarthy is engaging in, very targeted and focused strategies, are the kinds of things you have to do. Because you're just not going to actually encounter as many people in the same kind of space that you will in a city like New York. So you know, the gang violence reduction strategy that actually tries to pinpoint the groups of people who are the most involved in violence, that's what we're doing in Chicago, is a really good strategy, not only for Chicago, but also for New York.
Tracy, one of the things that has happened here in Chicago is the closing of some of the police districts. And I'm wondering, how do you think that has played into some of the challenges that Chicago may be facing as opposed to New York, especially the districts where crime is pretty high, like on the west side?
Yeah, I think the important thing to do is to consolidate resources so that they can be deployed most effectively. And so if you have the appropriate intelligence so that you can actually send resources to where the problem is, I'm not sure. I'm not as concerned about the consolidation of the districts so much as making sure that that consolidation doesn't compromise the appropriate intelligence and information that the agency needs to have in order to deploy resources.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC in New York with Tony Sarabia on WBEZ in Chicago. And our first guest for this special co-broadcast, Tracy Mears, criminologist from the Yale Law School, formerly from the University of Chicago. I guess we can call New Haven, where Yale is, just a northeast ward of New York City. Or maybe not. I don't know. But Tony,
hey, Brian, let's,
you have a caller, right?
Let's take a call. This is Malik from Marquette Park, which is in Chicago's near South Side area on Line 5. Hi there.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Thanks for tuning in this morning. What's your question or comment?
Well, I've lived in Chicago my entire life. I've lived in many of the neighborhoods, Pilsen, Little Village, Back of the Yards. I was on the South Side or on Market Park when it's seen a real big racial shift from, you know, blue-collar white to mainly African-American and Hispanic. And so I've seen gangs. I've seen guys pull guns. The biggest problem in Chicago is any 15-year-old can get a gun in his hands. He's just got to say, I got a beef with this kid, I got a problem with that kid, and it's not hard for him to find a gun from a friend, from a gang colleague, from wherever he's got to find the gun. If you pull that gun out of the equation, it becomes a fist fight. It becomes a rock fight. It might become a stabbing. But if you see video surveillance footage of a lot of the ways these people shoot each other, they're hundreds of feet away from each other because they're terrified. They don't walk in very close proximity to the person they're going to shoot. They just go crazy, you know, shooting and trying to hit their target. And so if you remove guns out of the equation, I think that's where these numbers will come down. In addition, the New York comparison, really, if you've lived in Chicago and gone, and I've lived in New York and I've lived in Chicago. My dad left to Brooklyn, so I've lived in New York. There's no comparison. So Manhattan has changed so dramatically in the last 20 years in terms of money, in terms of, you know, changing all the neighborhoods.
But it's not just Manhattan.
There, in Racine, in Chicago, and Englewood, that neighborhood has not changed through gentrification or through rehabbing or through anything. So
Malik, what do you think the Chicago police should be doing to take away those guns? I mean, the Chicago Police Department has some ideas.
It's tough on the police because what can a cop do if he has no idea that I'm going to get a gun? What can a cop do if he has no idea? You can't have police just asking every black and Hispanic kid on the streets to lift their shirt. You know, I used to have a music shop in Ford City Shopping Center where we used to sell mixtapes. And I could guess which kids had guns under their sweatshirts or whatever. And in the mall, we've seen people pull guns in the mall in broad daylight and have fights. And, you know, close to have shootings. I've never witnessed a shooting there.
And I want to bring in a corrections officer from Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn, on that very point. You can't just look at every kid who looks like he has a gun under his sweatshirt, who you think might, and take a look. Well, maybe that's what the stop and frisk program is. At least that's how it feels to many people in neighborhoods like Bedford-Stuyvesant in Brooklyn. But here is Albert, a corrections officer from that neighborhood, calling in. Hi, Albert. Thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. First of all, I'm a New York State corrections officer, and I just recently, past 6 years, I moved into Brooklyn, especially Bedford-Stuyvesant, which like 10, 15 years ago, and you wouldn't even step in because of the high crime area. And plus, I'm a white Puerto Rican, so I don't want to make it seem it's a white person that's calling. So anyway, what I basically want to say is in the projects, especially in the low-income projects, you have the grandmothers, the mothers, the fathers, you know, they're saying they want police protection. They want because of the high crime area. But then when the police make the arrests or do the stop and frisk, then they all start crying and yelling and saying that it's racial profiling, that their kids are being picked on. But then, you know, you think is you can't have it both ways. There has to be a balance. Either they want the police protection doing their jobs or they don't. And then this is where the crime keeps going up.
And the balance is very tricky, and that's why so many ordinary citizens in Bedford-Stuyvesant and other neighborhoods feel caught in the middle. And so, Tracy Mears, let me ask you, as a criminal justice professor, and I don't know how much you've studied this, and we're not going to spend the whole hour debating stop and frisk, but from your understanding, do police strategies even have to do with it? One graph I saw shows murders declining at about the same rate before stop and frisk as after it started in New York City, and critics say that refutes the claim that it's even having an impact.
So here's what I want to say about what police can do, and less to say about stop and frisk, because I think part of the problem there is that you don't have good enough data to actually make the claim that the New York Police Department is making, that stop, question, and frisk is responsible for the decline in crime and homicide that's in New York. But I want to go back to Malik's point, and that is this. He says if you get the lethal technology out of the hands of kids, then it's going to make a difference, and that's absolutely right. And one of the things that Gary McCarthy is doing in Chicago is speaking directly to the people who are involved in groups and gangs and saying to them in a collaborative effort between law enforcement, social service agencies, and people who actually used to be involved in the life of crime, you have to put the guns down. Just put the guns down. Stop shooting each other. Because we care about you, and because it is our job to keep this community safe. The whole strategy is articulated quite beautifully in my colleague David Kennedy's book, Don't Shoot. And we can show that when we do that, it does result in a change of homicide. We actually did a program in Chicago for the last 10 years, Project Safe Neighborhoods, that's based on this particular strategy. And when we started it in the first 5 years of program, there was a 47% decline in the average rate of homicide on Chicago's West Side. I'm also doing a replication of the strategy in five areas of New York, Harlem, the Bronx, Brownsville, and Brooklyn, and Schenectady and Albany. And we expect to see some pretty dramatic declines in homicide in New York as well.
Tracy Mears, we're going to have to let you go, but I want to thank you so much for tuning in on The Morning Shift and The Brian Lehrer Show out of WNYC in Chicago. Tracy Mears here on The Morning Shift. She is with Yale University. And I'm Tony Sarabia at WBEZ. Brian Lehrer in New York, WNYC. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back after this. It's The Morning Shift here on WBEZ Chicago. I'm Tony Sarabia. Joining me from WNYC in New York, it's Brian Lehrer of The Brian Lehrer Show. We want to hear from you. We are talking about policing strategies in both Chicago and New York. Here in Chicago, Brian, our number is 312-923-9239. The Twitter hashtag is Flashpoint.
And on WNYC in New York, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. In Chicago, once again, 312-923-WBEZ, 312-923-9239. And let's go right to a phone call. Marcus in the South Bronx. You're on WNYC and WBEZ. Hi, Marcus.
Yes, hi.
Hi, Marcus.
Thank you very much. It's ironic that the police are the first line of defense for the poor, but they go through our neighborhoods like an occupying army. And everyone in the neighborhood will tell you, innocent and guilty alike, that they're all afraid of being shot down by the police without provocation.
You know, we have a neighborhood here called Beverly where a lot of police officers live. We have a caller on line one. And I want to get Preston, good morning, first of all. I want to get your reaction to the caller in New York in terms of how they view the police in poorer communities. How do you view it here in Chicago? What sort of advice would you have for our New York caller?
Well, I would say to the New York caller that policing strategy certainly manifests differently based on the neighborhood. Living in Beverly, as you mentioned, there are quite a few police officers and firefighters who live in Beverly, and Beverly is not the same as, say, Grand Boulevard in Chicago, which is kind of a very high crime area. So the interaction between citizens and police officers is very different. So I could, like in Beverly, you won't have people saying things like, oh, you know, I'm afraid I might get shot without provocation. But in an area perhaps like Grand Boulevard or something, you have people who are a little bit more hesitant to approach police officers and things like that. So, I mean, I can see his point. It's very different based on neighborhood. It's not the same.
You know, Preston, your dad is a cop. How does he view his job in terms of community relations? And where is he based at in Chicago?
Well, he's a retired police officer.
Okay.
He was based for many years in the Grand Crossing area of Chicago. So mm-hmm. along the area, I would say from about 79th and Cottage Grove, moving north through areas like Inglewood and that sort of thing. And he was a beat cop. He was on the street. And his opinion is that there was a time when beat cops were really, really common in Chicago,
yeah.
You know, and police officers were able to work in the same neighborhoods for years. And you built a relationship. You knew who lived in the neighborhood. You knew what car didn't belong in the neighborhood. If a crime was committed, you probably had a pretty good idea who even down to the particular crime. Like if it was a smash and grab, it was probably these guys over here. Or if it was something more serious, and it's probably these guys. Or you could walk down the street and instantly know this person doesn't live in the neighborhood.
Hey, can I ask you, Preston? Preston, this is
the people in the neighborhood got used to you. They knew who you were. You know, okay, here's this guy. I can talk to this guy. He's been around here for years. He's seen my kids grow up. That relationship is gone. In Chicago right now, and I understand that they're sort of trying to get back to that.
Right.
But I would agree with my dad is that, you know, so now what it creates is just this officer-citizen relationship, and you've got people who are able to do, because of that, you've got people who can do things in sort of relative anonymity. you know.
Hey, Preston, can you hear me? Preston, it's Brian in New York. I'm curious, from your experience and your father's experience, if police officers sometimes live in the neighborhoods that they police, or at least within the city limits of Chicago. It's one of the ongoing issues here in New York that cops don't live in the neighborhoods. In fact, many commute in from the suburbs. And there's this sense that they have to be trained to understand the police, the policing that they're going to have to do, they have to be trained to understand the communities that they're going to be policing in, which they don't have a visceral feel for. Is that less of a problem in Chicago, do you think?
Well, Chicago, because of the physical space in Chicago, Chicago can be very polarized. You can live your entire life in one neighborhood of Chicago, having never crossed into another area. But I think that living in the neighborhood is a huge plus. I mean, you can't beat that. But I think being allowed to work in the same neighborhood for a number of years can be equally effective. You know, I think rotating police officers in any city, rotating police officers in and out of neighborhoods, I think is extremely damaging.
Yeah, Brian, one of the things that's happening here in Chicago is there have been some switches, as I mentioned to Tracy Mears, that there have been some consolidations. And the biggest one of the complaints from not only aldermen but residents as well is you're taking away police officers from a neighborhood where we've tried to establish relationships, and where we have established relationships. We knew our beat officer, and now they're moving out. You know, Marcus, I don't know if he's still on the line. It may be a little different when you're dealing with public housing, because it may be a tough sell for a police officer to move there. But I'm wondering, Marcus, how else, if you're still there, how else or what else do you think police should do when they do enter the low-income housing in terms of trying to establish relationships with the
residents? Well, I think they should demilitarize the police. I believe probably the occupying army in Afghanistan is probably treating those insurgents better than New York City police officers are treating its citizens. And if you look at the statistics, even black cops, they run the risk of being shot by white cops. There's never been an incident in New York of a white cop being shot by a black cop. It's always been a black cop shot by a white cop. So even black police officers are not safe.
Marcus, but when you say demilitarize, what do you say to the previous caller who was a New York State corrections officer who, you know, kind of looked at it from the other side and say, well, on the one hand, the community asks us to back off. On the other hand, they want us to stop gun crime, which has been done to a fairly effective degree in New York City. What do you want the police to do to stop crime?
Well, I think they should work scientifically effective. What they need to do is we have a gun culture in the United States. Millions of guns being produced. And I don't think there's an easy answer. Until we get to the point where Americans are less concerned with their Second Amendment and more concerned with being friendly with each other, we're going to have problems.
Marcus, thank you very much. I appreciate you chiming in. And Preston and Beverly.
Preston, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Before we go on to our next pair of calls, I understand we're going to pair up two callers, next one from New York, one from Chicago. Tony, are Chicagoans following this gun control debate in Washington very closely, and our city officials, do they feel like it's relevant to the Chicago issues that we're talking about, or is it off somewhere that has to do with, school shootings in the suburbs?
Oh, no, it's very relevant. And there are a couple of reasons, Brian. Of course, the tragedy of Hadiya Pendleton, the young woman who was shot while standing in a park with her friends. She was part of the inauguration celebrations for President Obama's second inaugural. And not only that, you know, we are under under pressure here in Illinois to pass a concealed carry law because of a U.S. Supreme Court ruling, an Illinois Supreme Court ruling. We were the holdout in the whole country. So the debate is very relevant to not only what's going on in Washington, but certainly to people all over Illinois, because of the fact that we have to have this law in place pretty soon. And because of Illinois being, you know, rural, suburban, and then here in Chicago, Cook County is one of the biggest counties in the country, there are a lot of different issues at play here. So, you know, if you're a hunter in rural Illinois, do you want the same laws that people are pushing in Chicago? So, yes, people are really paying attention to not only what's going on in Washington, D.C., but even closer to home here in Illinois.
All right, let's get a couple of more callers up. Gahan in the East Village in Manhattan, New York City. Gahan, you there? Gahan, I'm sorry.
Hi, Gahan.
That was my error. I needed to click or re-click. I think I'm having a little technical problem.
While
there,
you're doing
now,
that, we got a couple of tweets.
Gahan.
Let me just read a couple of tweets. This one
sure.
from Marty Gleason. It says, when discussing reducing crime in New York and Chicago, we have to address disproportional minority contact. That's something that Marcus was talking about, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Siva Mettimber says, what about allocating money for regular counseling in schools? So, you know, it goes beyond just, Brian, boots on the ground, if you will. A lot of people talk about a holistic approach and that phrase wraparound services when it comes to fighting crime.
So we have Gahan in the East Village, and you have somebody? Okay, we'll get to a Chicago caller in a minute.
We have John from Oak Park. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi. Now, I should tell your listeners in New York, Oak Park is right outside of Chicago's borders. It butts up against Chicago. So that'll give you a sense of where John is calling from Oak Park. Hi, John. Thanks for tuning in.
Yes, sir. Every day.
And what's your question or comment?
The comment is, as far as I can see, there needs to be more sense of responsibility among parents. I think that if a child of 15, 13, 12 is caught with a gun, I think the parents ought to be pulled in as well. I'm not sure they should be arrested, but I'm thinking perhaps some sort of public service because I don't think they're doing the responsible thing and taking care of their children the way they should be.
Gahan, you want to jump in and tell us what you were calling about?
Yeah, it's kind of similar. I'm saying that you framed it as a gun violence problem, and it's obviously terrible. But what is it about this culture of violence where people, and it mostly affects poor black communities as opposed to, you know, more affluent communities. That
and youngsters.
There's just so much impetus to kill and do serious damage to people over all these slights or pressures. And I think it's a culture of violence that, you know, guns, yes, obviously a big problem, but having this, like, bloodlust that you will beat down or stab or kill a rival just because of normal pressure, you know, we have to look at that.
You know, John, how would you say that poverty plays a role in this? Because if you look at crime stats over years, over decades, there a lot of people argue there is a correlation between the economy at a certain given time. And I'm wondering, you know, because of where a lot of violence happens in Chicago, these are very poverty-stricken neighborhoods.
Well, I think there's two parts to this. You had somebody on last week or the week before that was talking about the lack of discipline in the adolescent brain, that the adolescent brain has not yet discerned what consequences may come from certain actions. And it's only when someone turns into their 20s that comes into being. But there's another side to that, and the statistics show that there is much more violence among single parent homes than there are in two parent homes. And there's no distinction between heterosexual parents and homosexual parents. In other words, two parents is much generates a child with much better self-esteem and much lower propensity for violence. And those statistics came from people you had on WBEZ mm-hmm. over the last couple of weeks. I think that part of the problem we've got is that kids are just allowed to run, to do whatever they want. And, of course, as children, they don't have the same experience and understanding of consequences that the parents do. And I think those consequences are not being transmitted to the children.
And, Gahan, I wonder about that gang culture that you're talking about, where people shoot each other for slights and things like that, and whether people arm themselves to the teeth in gangs because of a macho aggression or because they feel that they're doing it in self-defense. Because I know people in some tough neighborhoods in New York who say, I don't want the government telling me I can't carry a gun because I carry a gun to protect myself because that's the only way I can protect myself because so many bad guys are armed. What do you think about that balance between offense and defense in the reason that people, even in gangs, carry guns?
Well, I'm going to say right off, I do support being able to carry guns and have legal means to do it. It's, you know, I don't need to tell you, it's virtually impossible in New York to do that. But, you know, so yes, you're talking about a chicken and an egg problem. They're coming after me. I better be armed. I don't know how to end that. But I would say you don't have a similar issue, at least on this kind of super aggressive street level, in like in the East Village, for example. You know, people just don't shoot each other across Tompkins Park. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe they did 20 years ago. But, you know, you have, because obviously it's an expensive neighborhood now, and it's a stable neighborhood. But I would say, yes, you do have to have that option of defending yourself. So if you can't trust the police to do it, then yes, and you've worried that the guy across the street is going to be taking a pot shot at you, mm-hmm. you probably will go out and try and get a gun to shoot back.
Gahan, I'm going to leave it there. And I want to bring in, Tony, if you don't mind, a former member of the Tactical Patrol on the NYPD, who's retired now, Joe in Middle Village, Queens, who, Joe, I gather, served a long time before stop and frisk. But I wonder what you think about what Gahan was saying. And from what you've seen in your experience, and you can tell me what that has been, whether even gangs arm more out of macho offense or personal defense.
Good afternoon or good morning. I don't know if it was Chicago or New York. The big thing here is that there's a lot of talk about how to do it and correct it by using some type of, morality in it. The whole thing is, with the Tactical Patrol Force, there were only 254 men. And they were divided into different groups who would go out into the neighborhood. Once they got into the neighborhood, crime stopped because the local people, the adults, said the TPF is here. The people who were committing the crimes knew that they could not get away with anything. And all the talk about different ways to solve the gun violence and to solve the crime is very nice, but the one thing that's lacking is fear on the part of the people who are committing these crimes.
Well, there seems to be a fear on the part of a lot of innocent people who aren't committing crimes, that they're going to be stopped and frisked, and maybe they'll find a little pot on them or something, and they're going to wind up with a criminal record. When you say they knew that the TPF, the Tactical Police Force, was on the ground and stopped the crime, once you were on the ground, what did you actually do?
Once we were on the ground, we worked in pairs, and we were able to, at that time, go and stop the people, just like stop and frisk now. We also were able to make car stops. We were also able to get in with the local older people who trusted the TPF and who would come and very quietly say that one and give us direction as to what was going on.
Does this approach sort of move the problem out of the area and to somewhere else? I think that's a question that a lot of people have about policing strategies, that if you – and we're doing it here in Chicago, sort of a saturation of hotspots. Does it solve the problem here but then move it to another place?
No, because the hotspots are hotspots. The cold spots are cold spots. So if you're going to say, what, are they all going to move out of Bedford-Stuyvesant and then go into Greenwich Village? I don't think so. They're going to stay in Bedford-Stuyvesant. It's a hot spot. The people who were living there, the older people, were smart enough to know that the TPF came to protect them.
And, Joe, I'm going to leave it there as we are up against a break here. And, folks, you're listening to a special co-call-in on guns, violence, policing in communities from WBEZ Chicago and WNYC New York. After the break, we'll talk to two reporters, one from WNYC and one from WBEZ, who are covering the impact of violence and policing in our two cities. Brian Lehrer, Tony Sarabia, back in a minute. Welcome back, folks, to a special co-broadcast from WBEZ Chicago and WNYC New York on guns, violence, and community policing. I'm Brian Lehrer in New York. My co-host is Tony Sarabia of WBEZ's Morning Shift in Chicago. And for our final segment, let's welcome two reporters, one from each of our stations, both covering the impact of violence and policing in our respective cities. Natalie Moore is a reporter for WBEZ's Southside Bureau, a former print reporter. She's the co-author of two books, Deconstructing Tyrone, A New Look at Black Masculinity in the Hip-Hop Generation, and Almighty Black Peacestone Nation, The Rise, Fall, and Resurgence of an American Gang. Natalie, hello from New York.
Hi, Brian.
And in New York, you have your reporter, Brian, Kathleen Horan, who's been covering something that we probably wish we could do here, but it would take a long time. You've been talking, Kathleen, to parents of people who have been shot and, in most cases, killed, I believe.
That's right.
What has that been like? What is the common thread that you've been finding?
A lot of what you're hearing from callers, there's poverty, young black and brown boys, many of them who are in street crews or gangs. These are the kids that are often the victims of violence and who die.
And Natalie, you know, it's interesting, or it's great that Brian mentioned that one book about black masculinity, because we heard a lot about that in the last segment about gangs. And a lot of your reporting has covered gang culture. And one of the interesting things that Natalie has uncovered is, look, a lot of times police here in Chicago say these are gang-related shootings. And Natalie, you found that that's not always the case, and it distorts the picture.
Right. Gang can be an easy shortcut in describing something because people may have a mental picture in their head, oh, where these are people who are deserving to die. They've decided to join an organization. So, you know, that's what it is. And when actuality, we're seeing more street crews, neighborhood formations, people on their blocks getting together. And I think it's important to note because gang is such a sweeping term. And yes, Chicago does have gangs, but we have a lot of splintered organizations. The gangs today are nothing the way they were 20 years ago or even 30 years ago when it really was at its peak.
You know, in your NYC series, Kathleen, called In Harm's Way, which again, you're chronicling the life of every child killed by a gun in New York City this year, are you finding that a lot of the perpetrators and victims are indeed part of the gang culture in New York City?
Well, that's what the police say. Most of these kids were either killed by another, by a suspect who was in a crew or a gang, and many of these victims, police say, were part of a crew or a gang. But, you know, we hear similar things, too, and we have more prevalence. You know, crews are growing, we hear, here in New York City, and there's less gangs, and they're very loosely affiliated, based on turf, and so there is a lot of that going on.
And you have a clip to play?
Yes.
Kathleen?
Yes.
This is from one of your pieces.
That's right. Should I set it up? This is from the profile of 17-year-old Xavier Granville, who was shot and killed last December 29th in Far Rockaway, Queens. His mother, Shakira, says he was leaving a birthday party, and she explains that, you know, when her son was even a young teen, she had many reasons to worry about his safety.
It was like a matter of respect. We could fight, and I may beat you up, or you may beat me up. Why you gotta go pick up a gun? These are kids you grew up with, literally, like, been in your house.
A year ago, Xavier was shot in the leg in the lobby of his own building. The police say they believe he was affiliated with a gang, but his parents say that wasn't the kid they knew. Granville says you don't have to be a gangbanger to fight.
He a boy, and I didn't see nothing wrong with fighting. You gotta protect yourself. You gotta stand up for yourself.
Xavier was arrested a number of times, but Granville says he had no felonies on his record and that many of the arrests were for trespassing in their building. She says she decided to pull him out of school in an attempt to keep him safe.
That's why I started getting him homeschooled, because I'm not also scared of the kids outside. I was scared of the police, too.
That's a powerful clip from a murdered child's mother, a murdered 17-year-old's mother, from that piece by WNYC's Kathleen Horan. Natalie Moore, I want to ask you, because I thought I heard that wobbly line again in that clip, that wobbly line between offense and defense, between why do these kids who fight then have to go and pick up a gun, between that and they got to protect themselves. What do you think about that?
Well, a lot of these, even when we hear, you know, gangs or crews, this isn't inner gang fighting. It's not always, oh, my crew is going against your crew. It's hurt feelings. It can be over a girlfriend. It could be someone who just got out of prison is back on the block. It could be honking your horn too loudly on a block that you're not familiar with and someone comes out and then it gets into an altercation. And all this, I think, leads to, you can point to a couple of things, lack of mental health services. I think the stress of living under poverty takes its toll on some people. And it's also this, you know, going back to masculinity. If you have access to a gun and you want to, you know, protect yourself, prove that you're hard, not be punked, that's how these little altercations blow up into major gun violence and murder.
You know, Brian, we have a call from Dennis in downtown Chicago here who works with kids who gets into these kinds of situations. Let's hear from him. Hi, Dennis. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good.
I want to tell that lady she's spot on. Now, the thing that we need to talk about is the root cause analysis. How do we solve that problem? I work with a youth group on the southeast side of the city in one of these embedded areas, hot embedded areas. And I also work with an organization called St. Leonard's House in Chicago, near the Chicago Bulls Stadium. And this is where men come out of prison, and they try to get their lives back in shape, and they try to transition back into the real workforce, okay? And St. Leonard's has a very good record for people not returning to crime. But, however, I have never, ever seen anybody doing reports in there. Come over to St. Leonard's even and talk with the men as to why they carry guns, why they commit crime, why all this, to address the root cause problem.
And what do you hear from those men who say why they carry a gun?
Why they carry a gun? Well, some of them have given up. A lot of them have given up hope. Let's look at it. Everybody talks about let's put these guys in prison, let's put them in jail, and all of this. And what have you done once you put them in jail? You've taken them out of society because now they can't vote. There's a lot of restrictions. They can't get jobs. So what am I going to do? You've taken away my pride. Yeah, maybe I made a mistake. But there is no way for me to regain the pride or a chance to be a productive citizen in society.
But do they see those as reasons why they need to pick up a gun, though?
Yeah, they give up. What have I got to lose? Hmm. That's the mentality. What do I have? I've lost everything. What do I have to lose? Yeah.
So let me add a caller from the Bronx to this conversation. Ralph, you're on the air in New York and Chicago. Hi, Ralph.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
Now, I grew up in public housing. I have four kids. I'm the youngest of four. I'm a professional musician. I just played with Sting last night.
Huh.
I have a business that I opened in the South Bronx, and I hire kids from my community. Now, this is the thing that I know for just working and living in public housing. The biggest problem that we have is these kids are absolutely afraid, and that's why they go out and they get these guns, because they're afraid of what they've seen and the things that are going on around them. But the biggest thing that needs to happen to change this from the bottom up is what I think his name was Preston, I believe, was talking about getting cops back on the beat. So some friends of mine and I, some different projects around the city, are starting this thing called Back to the Beat Initiative, where you get cops, because the only thing that's going to change this problem is that if the cops are familiar with the community and the community is familiar with the police officers, that will make people understand that you can trust these folks. When I grew up, Officer Dowie knew everybody, knew the criminals, and knew what was going on because people would tell him. Now that we have cell phones and things of that sort, these things can be cut down. These crimes that are going on, just understanding that cops are human. The cops that are coming in and out of the community are going home to different areas that have nothing to do with public housing. So they go to the, you know, they have cop bars that they talk about, you know, the things that they did that day. The guy in the TPF or whatever he was talking about, whatever numbers he was describing, absolutely okay. However, it's just like bug spray. And you excuse my use of that, but when you spray a mosquito or if you spray any bug, once you spray that bug and you finish, you got to keep spraying or they're coming back. Now, understand what that means.
Going,
you've got
right.
to clean up the community.
And then,
this stuff keeps going on. So the numbers game in the police department is what we're fighting against, the numbers game.
Kathleen Horn, you want to get back in on this?
Well, I mean, I hear the same thing from people, is that they have this almost nostalgia for the beat cops, where there would be a certain level of respect, that there, you know, maybe someone would know their name, a cop, they could ask them a question, and that there wasn't this sort of instant assumption that, you know, their child, that them, you know, is a perpetrator. And that there's a certain level of respect and interaction that is less, you know, top down. And so I do hear that a lot.
Brian and Natalie.
Tony, go ahead. Sorry, Tony, go ahead.
Yeah, Natalie Moore here. You know, it doesn't really exist to the extent that it could, I guess, in Chicago. But Natalie did a story. You did a story about the city of Elgin, which is outside of Chicago. Somebody else did the story about Elgin. And they actually embed cops in the community. Let's hear a clip of that.
The city rents a home right in the middle of a neighborhood that I'm responsible for, and the house that they selected has a office right in the front. So basically, when people come, they can either knock on my office door or my residence, and they say, well, I got an issue, can I talk with you? And this is basically where people will come for small meetings, whether it's a neighborhood meeting or people who want to come and talk to me about a major issue in their neighborhood. They come and they knock on the door sometimes at 1:30 in the morning. Basically, inside my office, you've got my desk, my office, and then you got some chairs set up specifically for people to come in. If they want to make a report, I've got all the police reports and all the information that they would need to fill out if I had to. So it makes it easier for them. They don't have to go all the way to the police station. I can do general reports here if I have to, accident reports. I can do any type of report right now.
So it's sort of a mini station here / community meeting space.
Right. It's used for meetings. It's my backyard. It's used for people to get together and congregate. I've had meetings of 15 people at a time.
So that's a piece that was done a couple of years ago by our former host, Steve Edwards. The officer was Pete Almeida from Elgin, a pretty sizable city outside of Chicago, probably about, I don't know, 30 miles away from Chicago. And I'm wondering, both Kathleen and Natalie, and I'll ask you first, Natalie, is that something you think that can only succeed in a smaller metropolis?
Yeah, I'm not sure if, you know, in a big city like Chicago that would work, but I can talk about beat cops and what neighbors do want. Mm-hmm. These community policing meetings, a lot of residents who are frustrated by the crime, they're saying, we're doing everything that you're telling us to do. Phone trees, being engaged, but, you know, we need more beat cops out here walking, getting to know the neighborhood. You know, not just, you know, pulled over or driving in their car. You know, we are a city that's not as dense, but we do have pockets of density. We do have walkable areas. And I would say that kind of presence I'm hearing consistently, that people do want more beat officers, and they don't want them transferred out. I've heard that you get beat officers in, they get to know the community, and then the police department moves them to another hot spot, and you don't have that continuity and longevity in a neighborhood or an area.
And Kathleen, this incredibly powerful series that you're doing, where you're interviewing people who knew kids who've been killed by gunfire, that's the series. And folks, imagine what that beat must be like. But Kathleen, are you hearing, because you're not doing policy discussions, you're not debating stop and frisk. That's not what you're there for. You're there to do obits on kids killed by gunfire. Are people, are their relatives, are their friends bringing up community policing? Are they volunteering that they want something different from the police than they're getting?
I do hear that because, you know, I guess they're, most of the parents that I talk to, at least, they do blame themselves in some way. They don't blame the cops per se, because many of them tried to intervene. They tried to protect their kid, and it didn't work. And there's a lot of anguish about that. But they do wish that their child's life could have been more valued or more respected by police when they were alive, and that there could be more sort of collaboration, that there's this kind of talk in many neighborhoods about community policing, about collaborative law enforcement, that you don't just flood a neighborhood, that you don't just say, you know, you're a gang member, so you're stigmatized, so you're over there, you know, that there is this sense of, well, what's possible? Does it always have to be like this?
And Natalie, there's something I really want to ask you before we run out of time, because the word resurgence is in the title of your book, the resurgence of this particular gang. And when we talk about New York and Chicago going in different directions in terms of the number of murders, New York down, Chicago up, well, Chicago was going down like many American cities for years and years and only recently started going up. So I wonder if in our last minute you can reflect on that word resurgence in the title of your book. Did the gang you wrote about fade in its power and then come back for some reason?
Well, the resurgence we're talking about actually goes back decades. The gang started in the 1960s, and then it peaked in the late 60s, and then there was Libya and terrorism trials, and then fragmentation, and then the big leaders going to jail. But what I can say is Chicago's segregation, I think, makes this a lot tougher to deal with. And what you're seeing in the neighborhoods with these crews, and if kids are even going to a school outside of their neighborhood, just, you know, a few blocks away, that's a new territory. And so these little fiefdoms are really what are causing the problems, and they aren't necessarily gangs as the way most of us think of gangs.
And I have
that
to
is our
say,
Southside Bureau reporter Natalie Moore here in Studio 6.
This has been, as the clock is no longer our friend, a special co-broadcast between WNYC New York and WBEZ Chicago. I'm Brian Lehrer. Thanks for listening. My show is on WNYC and WNYC.org each morning from 10 to noon Eastern. Tony Sarabia, thank you so much for doing this. Lots to
Indeed.
Learn from our two cities, and hopefully we can continue to talk to each other on air and our respective websites. And, you know, Tony, we managed to get through the whole hour without you rubbing in the fact that the Bulls ended the Knicks' winning streak last night.
Well, you know, I wanted to leave that to you. Brian Lehrer, thank you so much for joining Chicago Public Media, WBEZ, and let's do this again. I am Tony Sarabia in Chicago. Morning Shift is on 9 a.m. Central every morning here in Chicago and at WBEZ.org. Thanks again, Brian and New York. Front and Center's Flashpoint is funded by the Joyce Foundation, improving the quality of life in the Great Lakes region and across the country. And thank you to callers from New York City and Chicago. Let's keep the conversation going. Standing by, Heidi Goldfein here on WBEZ.